This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are going to try something a little bit different. We are bringing you kind of a grab bag of our shows that illustrate different topics that we take on a regular basis. We'll be talking about this a little bit later on the program. We tend to be all over the map in terms of the stories that we do. Clive and Bundy, you'll hear a little bit about that. There's a pick from our local band series, a moment from one of the Sundance films that we covered this year, a film that I have to say kind of delighted us. And then a show about dialects, regional ways of speaking, in particular the Utah accent. And that's actually where we're going to start. We had a conversation as a staff about whether with the internet and with globalization, people in America were actually losing their regional accents, whether they were losing words and vocabulary in particular to their place. And we were especially interested in this question: is there something unique about the way Utahns speak? Joining us on the program, David Eddington. He is a professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University. We also had on the program Ben Zimmer. He's the language columnist for the Wall Street Journal. We got a lot of calls and emails during that program, people trying to pinpoint something unique about the way native Utahns speak. And as it turned out, that wasn't really that easy a task. David Eddington had previously noted that he had yet to find one single linguistic quirk particular to Utah, something that you couldn't find anywhere else. And that's where we began in the conversation.
Well, I would say the best thing that we found is the use of the word scone to refer to fry bread.
Yeah.
Rather than a pastry. I think that's the best thing. Another one that I haven't, a couple of people have mentioned slough to slough school, but I have found that some other places around the U.S. The expression for cute, for rude, for cool, that may be a Utahism. I don't know.
Huh.
I haven't found it anyplace else.
I think one of the most interesting things that you've written about or talked about is what you've called the euphemistic expletive. Oh, my heck. Or what the fetch. Is that
those
a Utah thing?
Those are very common. Those are very common, yes. My understanding is that you actually find that sort of thing among Amish communities as well.
Wow.
Maybe not the exact same things, but the use of euphemistic expletives.
Ben Zimmer, do you know anything about euphemistic expletives elsewhere?
I don't, but I mean, with something like that, of course, you know, you have to take into consideration social factors as well. And if there are religious reasons for being more euphemistic with swearing like that, then that could lead to those sorts of patterns. You know, it's interesting to look at. I'm thinking of one regional pattern that started in Northern California, and that's the use of hella as a kind of intensive adverb. So you can say that's hella good. Or if you want to be more euphemistic, you can say hecka, that's hecka good.
Right.
And so that one isn't tied to, you know, religion or anything like that, but it's interesting, like even these new forms can become euphemized. So hella becomes hecka in that same way.
Here's one word that just came to mind.
Yeah.
Do either of you know what hooky bobbing is?
Hooky bobbing. Wait, is it when you get dragged behind a truck in the winter?
You grab a hold of the bumper and slide.
I've hooky bobbed.
Possibly is a Utahism.
Wow. Ben, are you writing this down?
Yeah, that's unknown here back east, I guess.
Great. We are finding distinctive stuff. Good. Let's go back to the phones. Beverly is with us, calling from Manti. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. My husband's from San Pete County, where there was a huge influx of Danish immigrants. And I was told that some of the things that are unique to that area, or that I thought were unique to that area, had to do with the direct translation from Danish. One of those is in under. It's in under the sink. It's in under the bed. And the other one is ending a sentence with. So instead of saying, do you want to go with us, you say, do you want to go with? And the other thing was the pronunciations of A's and O's that were kind of swapped. So a barn is a barn, and to be born is barn. So that they traded those, and I was told it had to do with Danish sentence structure and Danish pronunciation. Just wonder if they have comment on that.
Hmm. David Eddington, that's probably yours. Go ahead.
Yeah. The Inundra, I've never heard. That's interesting. As far as, hey, we're going to the store, do you want to go with? You'll find that all over the U.S.
Yeah,
I don't believe that's a Utahism. And the other one was what we call it, the cord card merger.
Right.
So it's people who worship the lard and the ward in Spanish FARC. That used to get a lot of attention. People used to pay a lot of attention to that and say, oh, yeah, you can tell you're from Utah because you say that. The interesting thing about that is if you go to the northeastern U.S., they talk about the Florida Orange Bowl and the Part Authority. So that's nothing strange to Utah. In fact, you can find that in Ireland as well. There's the city of Cork, C-O-R-K.
Let's go back to the phone. John is with us in Taylorsville, Utah. John, welcome.
Yes, I had a comment and a little couple of questions. I once heard on public radio, and it was a linguist from back east, and he said that out in the Mountain West, there's a certain dialect called Utonics. And I wonder if they've heard that. Two words or phrases. Henri, is that kind of unique? Or you bet, as in somebody says thank you, and the other person says you bet.
All right, let's go. Let's work our way backward. You bet. Someone says thank you, and you say you bet. I've heard this too, that people have said that's a Utah thing. I don't think that's a Utah thing, though. Is it David Eddington or Ben Zimmer? Do you know?
Well, it exists here, but I've heard it from as a stereotypical thing from Minnesota also.
You
right,
bet, of course.
Betcha.
Yeah, you bet. You betcha. Fargo, heavens yes. Henri. Ornery is the word, of course, but Henri, I hear that expressed a lot. My folks in the Uinta Basin. David Eddington, is that a Utah thing?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I know that it was commented on by someone I know who came here from Scotland and said, what's Henri?
Ben Zimmer, are you mystified? Do you hear that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly not in my dialect region, but I could figure it out, I think, from the, you know, ornery becoming ornery. I don't know what the regional distribution is for something like that. It would be interesting. There are great resources available. For instance, the Dictionary of American Regional English is a wonderful resource that it took 50 years to complete, and it's quite comprehensive. It mostly focuses on the lexicon, of course, but it also covers, you know, pronunciation as well. So, you know, DARE, as it's called, might be a good source to check for something like that.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phone. Pam is with us in Salt Lake. Pam, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
So I actually am a linguist by training, and I'm not from Utah originally. I grew up back east, and so I'm always noticing about how people speak. And one thing I've noticed, and I don't know if it's unique to Utah, but it's a phone thing. People, before they hang up, they say, bye. And... I think men and women do it, although I hear women doing it a lot. So I was wondering from your linguist guest whether this is something you've heard in other parts of the country. I find it fascinating and something that I've noticed, I would say, in the past 5 years more than previously.
Well, there are two parts to this that interest me. Let's start with the bye. I hear that too. David Eddington or Ben Zimmer, what do you make of that?
You know, I haven't heard that, but often... we look for people's intuitions like that as a way to start a study. So I haven't heard of that before.
Oh, man. My neighbor, LaVie Nelson, God rest her soul, did it all the time. Ben Zimmer, bye. Do you hear that anywhere else?
Not in these parts. I don't know. That I would be interested to find out. And again, like David was saying, I mean, sometimes it's something that linguists themselves might not even be aware of until it's pointed out, and then you can actually start getting some real evidence to find out, yeah, this might be something particular to Utah or at least that region.
Just a quick one from Justin Davies. He's wondering about the word potato bug. Is that a Utah or Southern Idaho thing? David Eddington, do you want to put that on your list?
Yeah, actually, that's one of those words that varies quite a bit around the country. I lived in the South for a long time, and it's roly-poly. Or a pill bug in some places. Potato bug is definitely Utah, probably maybe other places in the West. I've seen it on a map, actually.
What do you mean?
Mapped out how they say different things.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and potato bug is one of them.
That's great.
One thing that I have, another insect name is the little insect that scoots across the top of the water. Lots of different words for that. The word that I grew up saying here in Utah wasn't even on the list of choices. I called it water skeeter.
Yeah, that's what we called it in Davis County, water skeeter.
Yeah, there are great maps for those sorts of things like insect names in the Dictionary of American Regional English, where in the 1960s, they would go out in their word wagons, they would do these surveys, and they'd have these questionnaires where they'd say, what do you call that kind of bug on the water? Mm-hmm. And then write down the answer and then construct maps. A lot of that has changed, of course, in the 50 years since those surveys were done. But we can develop new surveys and popular dialect quiz, and we still see, those types of differences in the word choice plotted out by region, and people can actually be quite surprised to find out that what they use is somehow distinctive to their region.
That was Ben Zimmer. He's the language columnist for the Wall Street Journal. We were also joined by David Eddington. He's a professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University. KUER has wrapped up its spring fun drive, but there's still time to pledge your support for Radio West. Go online to KUER.org, where you can become a sustainer for as little as $5 a month. I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, and we have to take a brief break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last April, a standoff played out in Bunkerville, Nevada, near the ranch of Cliven Bundy. Bundy said the federal government had no right, no constitutional right, to ask for grazing fees that accumulated over the years. And as you probably know, hundreds of supporters went out to Nevada to back Cliven Bundy. Some of them, of course, were armed. The tension ratcheted up as those supporters squared off against federal law enforcement officers. And eventually, this part of the story too, the BLM backed down and they were concerned about the safety, so they returned Bundy's cows. Now, when we spoke to Cliven Bundy, this was last summer, we wanted to talk to him about his religious motives behind the standoff. He had made this statement to a group in St. George where he claimed God had instructed him to tell county and state officials to, quote, disarm federal officials or risk civil war. Bundy said that he had had this spiritual experience before the standoff. He claimed to have had a revelation from God who directed his actions on that day.
Yeah, but let me give you a little bit of background. Of course, I'm saying that I do believe in God, and I believe that in prayer. And, I make the statement that, and I don't only make this, I mean, this is a statement that's made that our Constitution is a sacred document. Mm-hmm. It was, basically, it was a divine document. And, my answer to him is I know that those founding fathers, they got on their knees and they asked their Heavenly Father for guidance and direction. And when they went to those conventions to create our Constitution, that inspiration went with those men. And we did come up with a divine Constitution, a supreme law of the land, a Constitution better and greater than any other Constitution probably ever in the world, but surely anybody better than anyone on the earth today. And that is our guidance for this country and this government and we the people.
Well, wasn't
now, that,
the
but, I believe was divine and it was inspired.
Right. Let me just stop you there.
The morning of this.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Conference,
go ahead.
When we have the standoff, of course I get on my knees and I have some inspiration. I was a little surprised by the inspiration, tell you the truth, and I didn't really quite understand why that would be the. But what he asked is that we basically tear down these entrance to these national parks because they were restricting we the people from exercising our right to this, these public lands, And you got to remember, the people that were after me was the Park Service and the BLM. And so, you know, that made a little sense. But then the other thing was, the sheriff should, this talking about Clark County Sheriff Gillespie, should take away, it said disarm. Disarm the bureaucracy.
Wait, who said? You're saying God said this?
I said that was my inspiration.
Right, right. So essentially, God told you to ask the sheriff to disarm the bureaucracy, and the idea that God wanted you to get things back in order, to straighten things back out.
Well, that was his sort of his direction to me. He said, you know, that was the solution to the problem of the day. For as I knew, I didn't really feel like I was representing Clive and Bundy. I didn't really feel like I was representing God. I felt like I was really representing we the people. And I presented it in that way, to we the people, ask Sheriff Gillespie to disarm the bureaucracy. And you got to remember who the bureaucracy at that time was. They were like 200 armed agency up there, been harassing this valley and this area for about 3 weeks.
And on he went. As you know, it was a difficult conversation. That was, of course, Clive and Bundy, rancher from Nevada. And it was an interesting conversation. It was complicated. It was difficult. We were trying to get at his kind of religious motivations. That story was remarkable for all kinds of different reasons. I mean, it really personified, I think, a bigger story going on, obviously, between the state and the federal government, one that's still playing out right now. But that was part one of this story. The other part of the story that we were interested in was what we know about Bundy's way of looking at the world. And that's why we asked the journalist Scott Carrier on the program to join us, because he had gone down and visited with people in southern Utah who supported Clive and Bundy in this fight. So we had Scott on the program, as you know, probably radio producer, terrific radio producer and journalist. And we asked him what he understood about Bundy's way of looking at the world and why we might want to know about it ourselves.
I think he's not alone. I think that there are a lot of people out there who feel like he does, and I think it's actually about half the country. It's not a small number of people. It's a surprisingly large number of people who see themselves and the world in a similar way. And I think that's probably shocking to a lot of listeners. They probably don't agree with that, but that's because I think that our country is divided into two separate cultures and that we don't talk to each other. It cultures in the sense of we have separate cosmologies, which deal with, you know, questions of where we come from, why we're here, and where we're going. One side believes is based in faith and religion. They believe that God put us here to follow his commandments, that they have a happy life and maybe eternal life. And the other side is based in reason and science. They believe that we evolved from apes. And that separation is profound because we have completely different images of who we are and our relationship to the world around us based on those beliefs. And we have the same language, but the words mean different things. Mm-hmm. And so any conversation other than about the weather can quickly become volatile, even explosive, because we think the words are being used wrong, and it just upsets us, and we get really emotional. And so the result is that we don't talk to each other.
Yeah.
We don't usually, people mainly, you know, I think most public radio listeners or listeners of your show are on the side of reason and science. I think that's the way it breaks down. And we don't hear people like Clive and Bundy speak very much. But I've driven around a lot interviewing people at random, and I know that when you look at the voting results of the polls, it's about 50-50.
So you think a lot of people are raising questions about whether or not we should have given Mr. Bundy a platform. What you're saying is, what's wrong with hearing him talk about where he's coming from, I guess? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think we do need to listen to Clive and Bundy and try to listen to him without getting emotional, although it's hard for me. I mean, I was really kind of swarmed with emotions listening to him. But if we don't try to understand each other, then we have no hope of solving big problems. I mean, the one thing that the two sides agree on, it seems to me, is that this is the end of civilization, or something's coming to an end.
Yeah.
And yet we have completely different reasons for why that's happening, and one's the apocalypse, and one's the climate change. But it renders us helpless to actually deal with it at all. And so I think, yeah, there is an argument for listening and trying to understand, but it's a very profound gap, and I don't know what the solution is.
That was journalist and radio producer Scott Carrier responding to our conversation with rancher Cliven Bundy back in August. I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, and we have to take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Every January, of course, we head up to Park City to interview documentary filmmakers who are showing their work up at Sundance. So, and we did a lot of them this year. On the final day of the coverage, we had a conversation about this very weird and fascinating documentary. It's called Finders Keepers. At the core of the story, you may have heard this show, is a leg, an actual human leg, once belonged to a man by the name of John Wood. And John lost his leg in this airplane crash, and somehow his leg ends up in the possession of this wheeler-dealer guy named Shannon Wisnant. It was a story that had made the rounds in the local and national news, and it was, you know, it seemed like a kind of just a bad reality TV show, but the filmmakers, and we have on the program, Brian Carberry, Clay Tweel, and Seth Gordon, managed to turn it into something else, not just a doofy reality show that made fun of rednecks, but it was funny and poignant and complicated. We were interested in how they had wanted to tell this different side of the story in this battle over John Wood's poor shriveled leg. And so we talked to them. Here, you hear Brian Carberry's response to that question.
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that we all talked about a lot and I've talked about in past projects was, like, we really love to get to the heart of why people do what they do in any sort of context. And depending on their open and honesty and candor with the camera, it will kind of dictate how far we can go. And right. It just so happened for this film, John and Shannon and their families were incredibly open to us and allowing us to get into their personal lives and their family drama. So, I think a reality show kind of is different in kind, because it has like this kind of sheen of drama that is sometimes predictable and
fake.
Yeah, manufactured. Yeah, honestly.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Hence all of the story editors in reality television. and, you know, so I think we just tried to really get to the heart of why people do what they do.
So let me play a clip. The story begins when John loses his leg in a plane crash. We'll come back to that in a minute because that's an important part of the story, actually. But they have to amputate his lower leg. And he tells the doctors that he wants to keep it. And for some reason, he has this idea that they're going to deliver him this skeleton. But that's not exactly how it works. This is John Wood from the documentary Finders Keepers.
So Dwayne from Mortician picked it up from the hospital, and he handed it to me right out there in the driveway. It was this white trash bag. Hell, let me show you what it looked like. He reached in the back of his minivan, he comes handing me out this white trash bag, had this red tape around it, doing that thing like a Christmas present, and I run my hand across, and I looked at Dwayne, and I said, uh-uh. And as I was breaking this bag open, I got about right here like this, and I heard the damn door shut, and I seen nothing but dust going up the road right there, because he was gone. We're talking about a fourth generation mortician out the door. He didn't say bye or nothing. I said, oh no, what's going on? And I looked in there, and sure enough, they sent my whole leg back to me. I could see my tendon, my tibia, my fibula hanging at the top. It was five toes and his calf muscle down here. I ain't never seen nothing like that before in my life, man. Not even in the World War II flick. I'd seen some legs blowed off and stuff like that. But, I mean, when you're looking at your own stuff, whew, damn.
yeah, like, what do you say to that, right? I mean, it's such a great moment. And it's so funny, but, you know, the thing you get throughout this film is what great storytellers almost all of them are.
Yeah.
And is that the South? Is that what it is? I mean, because, I mean, you could hear John talk forever telling this story, and there are all kinds of stories. Shannon, who we'll get to, they're all such amazing storytellers.
Yeah, they all spin a good yarn, as they would say. Yeah. I mean, Shannon does, John does. I think John's sister, who, you know, I love her interviews and kind of what she had to say as well. They're all very, they kind of break down the stereotype. And if you can get past the accent and really listen, and you can understand the poignancy of some of their maybe perhaps wacky metaphors that they use, you know?
Yeah. So let me play another clip because I want to bring Marion Little into the conversation you mentioned. This is John Wood's sister. She is such a critical part of the film, I think. But we need to continue the story of the leg. So John takes his severed limb to a friend at the Hardee's fast food joint because he needs someone to stash it for him in a big freezer.
Yeah.
So she stashes it with, like, the biscuits and stuff or whatever.
Hands the leg through the drive-thru window.
That's the best part. That's the best part. Because the manager's not having any of it. He's like, absolutely not. You cannot keep this here. So John drives back.
Yeah.
She hands it to him through the drive-thru window, yes. Which is absolutely fantastic. John gets his hands on some embalming fluid, and he tries to baste the thing in a roasting pan in his shed. Here's Marion Little and John Wood as this story continues from the film Finders Keepers.
So he tore the screen off his front door and wrapped it up like a doobie.
Until I got the bright idea to mummify it and then hang it up in the possum tree, let it sun dry for 6 months.
But it wasn't long after that he got evicted.
Yeah, so that's when the leg ended up in his smoker.
That's when the smoker and all of John's possessions went into
the storage unit.
And John moved down to South Carolina.
Never paid his bill.
And my mom paid the first 3 months of the storage unit and said, after that, John, it's yours. When he didn't pay it. And here we are today.
I keep thinking you guys really lucked out all throughout the whole process of this because it seems like every kind of character that you encounter is amazing tape. Let's talk about Marion, though. She almost seems like she's one of the voices of reason in the film. I mean, how do you see Marion in the scheme of things?
Yeah, so the rest of her family all refers to Marion as Mama Hen, and she's kind of stepped up, you know, her whole life. She was the eldest, you know, she was the eldest sibling, and you know, she would see John kind of, you know, in his wayward adolescence. She always had to step up and be that voice of reason, and I think a lot of that comes off, you know, today.
I kind of see her as like the proxy audience voice, you know, of she's constantly chiming in being like, isn't this ridiculous?
Yeah.
Like, you giving them permission to laugh at the absurdity of it, but also kind of chiming in when needed to add some heart and depth to it as well.
There's one moment where this, and we'll actually play a section from this, but there's this news conference that plays out in the parking lot of a dollar store called the Dollar General. And just the name Dollar General, it seems so absurd. And there's this moment where Marion just kind of breaks down laughing over the absurdity of it. That was a really cool scene, I have to say, because you're right. I think she did give the rest of us permission to say, oh yeah, this is really funny.
Right, yeah. I think also kind of Shannon's mom does that to a certain extent as well. You know, whether it's when Shannon's talking about the story of his leg or kind of when we get into the past of Shannon's background,
yeah.
she weighs in to really kind of just, she's very straightforward.
And so that brings us to Shannon Wisnant. All right, so let me play a clip from Shannon, because now we get
to
sort of
how she... what you pulled.
What's that?
Can't wait to hear what you pulled.
It's so great, and you'll get a sense of him right off the bat. This is, we actually will hear from his mother, Shirley, in this too, because this is the moment where Shannon has purchased like a lot at a storage unit. John defaults on his storage unit, and so all this stuff gets sold, and he just buys this stuff at an auction, and he sees this grill, this smoker. And that's where we pick up the story. Here's Shannon Wisnant from Finders Keepers.
We took the grill away after the sale was over. It was the last piece we loaded and the last piece we unloaded. So I drug the old grill. I said, well, let's just see what this is. And I opened the grill up. I pulled this thing out, and it sort of looked like driftwood, you know, shaped odd, and but it's kind of heavy, so I knowed it wasn't driftwood.
He let out a yell in the building. Sounded like a war whoop.
My hand was dripping wet with cholesterol. What done run out of it?
Mom, I said, what?
My mother and her boyfriend come running, and they said, well, what did you find, Shannon?
He said, it's a human foot.
They said, a what? I said, a foot. And they said, a what?
You're full of it. No, I'm not. I said, yes, you are.
I said, a foot, you know, five toes and five toenails.
It was just unreal.
I drove up to the mini warehouse, and I took that foot with me. I said, you need to call everybody that you sold something to and tell them they need to look in there and see if any body parts in it. He said, you just need to throw that in the dumpster. I said, buddy, I'm thinking, well, you bumped your head, you're about crazy as hell. You think I'm gonna throw this sumbitch away?
And that there is the Shannon Wisnant, finder, wheeler and dealer extraordinaire from the film Finders Keepers. We spoke with the filmmakers of Finders Keepers, Clay Tweel, Seth Gordon, and Brian Carberry at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival, where their film premiered. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West.
And I'm Elaine Clark. Since today marks the final day of KUER Spring Fund Drive, Radio West is a sort of grab bag of some of our favorite interviews from the last year. From controversial issues to local music and film, Radio West is committed to bringing you stories that explore the way the world works. There's still time to make your donation. Become a sustaining member of KUER by pledging $10 a month. Just go to our website, KUER.org, for all the details. We're taking another break, and we'll be back with the local band Big Wild Wings. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So one of the things we do, we have a local music series, and it's important to us that it not just be about playing music, though. We try to get to as much of that in the show as we can. We're interested in the process, and we want to give local musicians a chance to talk about that music and, you know, where it comes from. Back in January, we had the band Big Wild Wings on the show. It's a Salt Lake trio, Lindsay Austin and Tyler Hummel and Chris Soper. Soper is the drummer, and the idea for the song The Grand Narrative started, he said, with him. He said it came, he had come to this low point in his life. He and Austin had both had some deaths in the family, and he was struggling with all of that. And The Grand Narrative, he says, is about, it's about life.
For me, The Grand Narrative is that life is beyond the individual. Before you were what you were food. And then after that, you know, you're something else is food, and then you're dirt, and then you're life for a tree, and then going to, I mean, it's just the overarching narrative of day to day.
Well, what you say is the grand narrative will take us all. Mm-hmm. She'll enjoy the trip before the fall. I like that. But I have to ask, there's this female figure in this song.
Hmm.
A woman, I guess, or maybe I'm misreading it, but I have to ask, like, who is she? Where did she come from?
For lack of a better word, we can call her Gaia. It's not really any religious placement, but
sure.
more this personification of the greater flow of of life, of chaos, of Earth, just the way everything goes. She, I guess, would be just the cycle of Earth. Dirt in her smile made me think.
Yeah, I like that line.
Mother Earth. And,
Lindsay, you say this has become one of your favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. We considered not putting it on the album, actually, because, you know, sometimes you just grow to hate your songs and then you learn to love them again. But we ended up having a good friend play cello on our album, and that kind of just changed this song for me. And it's not a bad song. I really love it, but that kind of gave me a new perspective on it. And I think the lyrics are so deep. I guess the reason I had a hard time with it for a while is because when we play it live at bars, it's kind of hard because people are like getting rowdy and drinking, and we're like singing this song about Mother Earth and how you're going to die.
Everyone,
you know,
get introspective over here. Yeah.
Right.
Finish your shots and take a look at yourself, okay?
Yeah, so I would just kind of look out in the crowd and see people like kind of. I couldn't tell if they were into it or if they were just
bored or thinking.
Yeah.
No, I promise you they weren't bored.
Okay, good.
Play the grand narrative. Okay. This is Big Wild Wings.
Side.
band Big Wild Wings with The Grand Narrative. It's from their debut album, Speaking in Cursive. We talked to them back in January. We should also say they're playing next Thursday. That's April 23rd at the Complex in downtown Salt Lake City. And we have details, as we always do, on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lynn Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.